You know, I watched Hillary's speech and she's talking about wages have been poor and everything's doing badly, but we're going to make it. She's been there for so long. I mean, if she hasn't straightened it out by now, she's not going to straighten it out in the next 4 years. It's just going to become worse and worse.
The voices of the two big winners at Super Tuesday's victory parties there, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. What did we learn last night about the presidential race that will culminate in November, these November elections for president of the United States? Joining us to answer that question and many others at this point in the presidential race, we have Mark Hemingway, senior writer for the Weekly Standard. Mark, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Hey, glad to be back.
And Molly Hemingway, senior editor for The Federalist. Molly, welcome back.
It's wonderful to be here.
We'll start with you, Mark, but it's also for Molly. What did we learn last night after Super Tuesday on the Democratic side?
Well, we learned two things. One is that this Democratic primary isn't ending anytime soon, but at the same time, as much as Sanders has various incentives and is winning by enough of a percentage in enough places to prolong the primary, it's also becoming clear that Hillary is dominating and there isn't much of a path to victory for Bernie Sanders. So, Sanders wants to push a specific agenda and possibly affect the Democratic, you know, party platform or policy approach down the road. And as long as he stays in the race and gets publicity, he'll benefit from that. But at the same time, I don't think anybody realistically thinks that he has a shot of winning the Democratic nomination at this point.
Your thoughts, Molly?
It's interesting that Hillary is a very weak candidate. She should have had this locked up. She should have done better than she did last night. But as Mark said, she's doing well enough that and Bernie's not doing well enough to fundamentally change the dynamics of the race. So the Democratic Party primary process is following a much more conventional path than the Republican one. And also the Democratic Party is able to exert much more control at the establishment level than the Republican Party would. And I think that's different than what you would expect, but that's clearly being shown in how their primary is playing out. They're able to tamp down the enthusiasm of their insurgency, and they have many more methods of controlling it. And it's also just easier to fight an insurgency, even a large one, when you've got only one competing candidate.
Well, there's another issue there with the Democratic primary, which is that if you look at what Democratic voters are saying about why they're supporting Hillary, well, a lot of them have a very favorable opinion of Sanders, even though they're voting for Hillary. They're voting for Hillary mainly because, you know, surveys show that electability is a huge factor among Democratic primary voters. That does not seem to be the case in the Republican primary, but that seems to be winning the day for Hillary. They think she can win in November and Sanders can't.
Some have observed that the Democratic Party, nonetheless, even though they seem to have kind of organized and sewn up things pretty well, other than pushing Hillary a little bit to the left, as we saw last night in her acceptance speech, still have a big problem. That is turnout. How do you explain, Molly, the record turnout among Republican voters during this primary season and significantly diminished turnout for Democrats?
This is a pattern that you're seeing in nearly every state, with maybe only one or two exceptions. Republican voter turnout is sky high, record levels of high. I think Vermont was the one exception last night. And Democratic turnout is quite depressed. So there are a couple things that are interesting there. One is that, actually, I think almost everything can be explained by the enthusiasm surrounding either Donald Trump or the efforts to stop Donald Trump. Clearly, new voters are coming into the process. I think it's entirely plausible that many of these are Democratic voters who like Donald Trump's more liberal, progressive policy positions or other parts of his position. Maybe they feel alienated by various other positions that the Democratic Party takes, and so they're happy to vote for Donald Trump. But also you're seeing just a ton of enthusiasm for efforts to stop Donald Trump. These might be people who are sort of typically Republican-base voters who care a lot about the pro-life issue or things like that. They are activated and trying to do what they can to stop him.
In that vein, I do wonder about a quote. This is from Jonathan Last, writing for the Weekly Standard, Mark. He has said, there's more evidence of Trump's weakness if you look closely. He says, why did he lose Oklahoma? He says, it's the only state where the vote was restricted to actual Republicans, which further bolsters the case that Trump is not leading a revolt from within the party, but staging a hostile takeover of it. What do you make of that?
Right. Well, there have been four states thus far that have had closed primaries, and Trump has lost three of them. So, yeah, I mean, it is very, when we talk about Trump and the GOP, we need to think about whether or not Trump is, bringing in people who wouldn't normally vote Republican into the Republican primary process versus whether or not Trump is completely scrambling the Republican coalition so as traditional Republican voters are voting, you know, in ways that would be contrary to their ideology. It seems to me that Trump has done a good job, in relation to the sky-high turnout in the Republican primary, of activating people to vote in the Republican primary that normally wouldn't be traditional Republican voters. But at the same time here, we're still looking at a situation where Trump is winning because he's winning a plurality of a very divided race. If you look at the overall popular vote in the Republican primary last night, Trump still only got 36% of the total vote. Now, that is, enough for him to win in individual states and come out looking like the winner. But, if a few days ago, if you'd looked at what Trump's projected delegate count would have been after last night, it would have, the median predictions, as my colleague Jonathan points out, would have been about 280 to 300 delegates Trump should have gotten. Instead, he came in with, 245? I mean, he actually underperformed last night. So there's no reason for Cruz or Rubio or any other alternatives to get out of the race yet.
We have talked about this before, Molly, but are the media ignoring the Pew survey that shows that regular weekly church attendance really is a factor when it comes to Trump support, and that those who do attend regularly show what they call a substantive opposition to Trump?
I think that the media are confused about what's happening with the evangelical vote. We've seen exit polls that show that there are evangelicals who are voting for Donald Trump, but on the other hand, much of the most strenuous objection you're seeing to a Donald Trump candidacy is coming from evangelical Christians. It's not a Pew study so much as analysis that includes a Pew study that showed that people who care a lot about social order and social cohesion are voting for Trump unless they go to church weekly. And if they go to church weekly, they're actually strongly opposed to Donald Trump. I think that's a very interesting issue that shows a divide between cultural Christians and actual weekly church-going type Christians. And one of the most interesting ways that this played out was in Virginia, which is where Mark and I live, where the precinct that houses Liberty University, whose president Jerry Falwell endorsed Donald Trump, despite everything he said about abortion, infidelity, and other issues, that precinct got only 8% of the vote went for Donald Trump. He actually placed fourth behind Rubio, then Cruz, then Carson. So you see this distinction between some of those big conservative players who are willing to sacrifice their ideals to get behind a Trump presidency and actual evangelicals and how they vote.
Donald Trump has cast himself for decades now as a deal maker, the deal maker. Molly, is there any evidence that a President Trump would have life, marriage, religious liberty as non-negotiables in his deal making?
No, and I think you're seeing him at his most conservative. In fact, I think that might have already passed. Last night, he began to switch to a more general election. He softened on everything, including his stance on immigration, which was sort of the horse that brought him to dominance in the Republican primary. He is a good negotiator, as evidenced by the fact that he is dominating the Republican primary. It's absolutely true. And it's interesting because I want to make a point. It's not just Democrats that are crossing over and voting for Trump, of course. It's also a huge part of the Republican base is just willing to burn everything down because they're so frustrated with the impotence and incompetence of the Republican Party. They say that they're sick of John Boehner making deals, or they're sick of Mitch McConnell making deals, and they would rather make deals with Donald Trump. The thing that is different is that you're going to get different deals from people who actually do care something about Republican principles versus people who care most about their own brand name or their own image. I think Donald Trump is not, he himself would not say that he's a principled person, or that's clearly not what's motivating his campaign, although he does have some issues that he seems to care about for at least some period of time. The thing is, there's no consistency to that. He has been all over the map on every single issue around, from racism to immigration to abortion to religious liberty, even religious liberty in the last year. So who knows where he'll end up if he should secure the presidency.
When we come back, we're going to ask Mark to respond to something Molly wrote this morning. His wife, she likened Trump supporters to the French Revolution. We'll find out what she means and what Mark thinks of it right after this.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking the November elections with Mark and Molly Hemingway of the Weekly Standard and the Federalist. Mark, your wife wrote this just this morning, in fact, about Trump supporters. She says, passionate and fed-up Trump supporters are going with the French Revolution approach, while the principal conservatives are going the American Revolution approach. What do you make of that?
Well, it's basically what Molly was saying about their frustration about wanting to sort of burn things down. I mean, they're not logically thinking about, well, here's what I think is wrong, and here's a way to achieve it, and here's how we should go down this path to get there. They're thinking that, you know, if they just, you know, create enough chaos that somehow an order will emerge out of this that will be more favorable than the existing order that they don't like. And then it's a very dangerous mindset, obviously. You know, you can't just burn down institutions and expect, you know, that have been built over a very long time and expect new ones to pop up that are more equitable and more, you know, just. So I get the frustration among Trump supporters, but I really don't know what to say about it, because it seems to be predicated on a lot of, you know, hope and faith in somebody I don't think you can place a lot of hope and faith in.
Well, I would be a little more open-minded about it, in the sense that they do have a case for it. It is, I mean, they're quite open and honest about their desire to see everything burned down. I think that it would be interesting to see what their case is for how things might possibly be better, or how it would be rebuilt better in a new system where the institutions have been destroyed. And I do think that the French versus American analogy is interesting, because the French project didn't work out quite so well. The burning down of the institutions, or the hostility toward them, did not leave much for civil society to keep from descending into absolute chaos and terror. Whereas in the American system, even with its flaws at the beginning in terms of not extending the claims of the Declaration of Independence to all people, such as, you know, there was still slavery and things like this, it was a good framework for working within the populace to increase freedom, or at least it was for a long time. The founders thought very strongly that you needed a virtuous people to have a healthy republic. I think that the problem with all the scenarios in play right now is that we don't have a very virtuous people or virtue-oriented society. We don't have strong families. We don't have even men in their own homes raising their own children. There's just a complete breakdown, an educational problem. This, to some extent, this political drama that we're seeing now is nothing compared to a much scarier and widespread societal breakdown that our founding fathers probably would have been absolutely horrified by.
Right. And then to some extent, that was the genius of the American founding, which was that, you know, it was a nation that was predicated on something beyond, you know, nationalism, in that, you know, it laid out this framework for how things should be done, and it amounted to, you know, every generation looked toward American founding documents and American founding ideals as a kind of cultural catechesis. And we're seeing that sort of completely break down. And I think it's kind of ironic because, you know, as Molly points out with these issues of the family and other things like that, you know, we now even have a situation where people like, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates, the liberal Atlantic writer, who's, you know, considered one of the big race issue experts, is now saying things and writing pieces about how Daniel Patrick Moynihan's report on the black family in the 1960s, which at the time was considered this horrible racist thing to suggest that liberal policies were destroying the black family, was basically accurate. Republicans themselves are now becoming affected by the things that they've been warning about. I think that there's a significant amount of people in the Republican Party that, you know, they have some sort of like cultural legacy from being Republican or religious, but they don't necessarily have the degree of catechesis in those values that allows them to, you know, see how maybe voting for a guy like Trump isn't the best idea. They're willing to just sort of roll the dice on a guy whose principles I think are a bit questionable.
Last night, Donald Trump in his news conference, again, for the umpteenth time, reiterated his respect for Planned Parenthood and strongly insinuated, as he has before, that abortion is a very small amount of their business, pledged to defund that little part of it. What are the facts on Planned Parenthood, Molly? And is Donald Trump simply misinformed or dishonest on this? What's going on?
Yeah, Donald Trump, who says he might be a Planned Parenthood donor, I guess that's for us to find out later as a surprise, has been using Planned Parenthood talking points, which have been discredited even by very liberal, progressive media outlets, such as that only 3% of their business is abortion. That is not, it is absolutely not true. They do things like count. If you come in for a service, they break up. If you come in for an abortion, your initial consult is considered not an abortion. If they give you aspirin or some type of pain reliever, that's not considered an abortion, but it's still considered a service. And so by breaking everything down into these discrete services, they count abortion just as that one little thing, even if it lowers the numbers ridiculously. But the major issue, I would say, is that he seems to not understand the fungibility of money. So Planned Parenthood is a billion-dollar corporation. It receives $500 million in taxpayer funding each year, and that funding can go to pay the abortionist. It can go to pay who does other things. It can go to keep the lights on in the clinic that does abortions but also does other things. And so it is a way to support these clinics, even if their primary moneymaker is providing abortions or ending the lives of more than 300,000 unborn children each year. So he thinks that it's okay what they do, even if that involves the killing of all these children, because he thinks that they do other things that they don't do. He has suggested, and this has been supported by media people who are ignorant, that Planned Parenthood does mammograms. As we know, Cecile Richards, finally put under oath and asked about this a few months ago, had to admit that Planned Parenthood has never done any mammograms, literally not a single one. And so the facts that he's spewing are just not true and very frightening and alarming, actually, to the pro-life movement, which has already lost out support in the Democratic Party and now seems to be about to be completely shut out of the Republican process as well.
The fungibility issue is key because when Donald Trump, you know, says he supports Planned Parenthood, but he doesn't support using taxpayer dollars for abortion, whatever, he's effectively espousing the official line of the Democratic Party on Planned Parenthood and pretending it's some new and different stance. I mean, that's literally the status quo right now, and is what, you know, pro-lifers are so object to, is that their own money is being used to further what they consider great evil. And it's just really bizarre that I think that there's a lot of Trump supporters that who haven't thought deeply about this, who maybe aren't, you know, maybe even reflexively pro-life, but you know, aren't actively so, seem to buy that argument or seem to think that it makes sense. So, well, if we could just give poor women health services but not pay for abortion, that'd be great. But it doesn't work that way.
There's another issue, too, which is, again, this is the most conservative he'll be. This is the most principled he'll be on abortion. His positions will, if past his prologue and if what he's written about how he makes deals is true, this will soften and moderate as the election continues. And this is dangerous for the pro-life movement because the pro-life movement is much more popular within the Republican Party than in the general. And so Donald Trump's position actually matches more of what a general election voter would be in favor of. And so I think it would be highly unlikely that he would somehow develop more strength on being pro-life as this process continues or if he were to become president.
But at this point in time, Molly, is your sense of his loyal following, do Trump supporters care about Planned Parenthood?
I don't think so. I don't think that, I mean, you're seeing people who are more ideologically motivated but also angry at the Republican Party for its incompetence are not behind Trump. People who are just angry at the Republican Party's incompetence but don't prioritize issues such as religious liberty or life, they're much more inclined to be Trump voters. And also there's this issue that's very interesting, which is some Trump voters are coming to their support of him as they're logically making decisions about who would be the best to take on Hillary or whatnot. Other people seem to be very just locked in with and unpersuadable by reason. And so they in particular wouldn't care. And you see them justify what he's saying as if he's not issuing Planned Parenthood talking points, or hurting the pro-life movement in any way.
Finally, for both of you, with about a minute apiece, can Trump be defeated if three of his four competitors stay in the race? Molly first.
I actually think that, and I think Mark will probably disagree with me on this, that it is a good idea for as many people as possible to stay in the race. I think that Donald Trump is the is undoubtedly the likely nominee, that the only that it's all but over, and that the only chance that people who oppose his candidacy have would be to have enough delegates going to other candidates to keep him from getting the majority needed. And counterintuitively, the more people who are in the race, it might play well. Cruz has done really well thus far. He's won all these different primaries. And he thinks that he would do better if Rubio were out. I think that there's a good argument to be made there. But it's also true that Rubio, who won Minnesota, might do well in some of the upcoming states, you know, like Illinois and Michigan, where the electorate is more like a Minnesota electorate than Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas. And Kasich could take Ohio. So it sounds crazy, but I think maybe they all stay in and they do their best to keep delegates away from Trump.
Mark?
I don't really actually disagree with much of what Molly said. There's no real argument for anybody to drop out at this point in time because Cruz did well last night, and some people would say, oh, well, Rubio should drop out. But the reality is those were his best states, whereas Rubio's best states might be coming up here soon. So in that case, you know, they both have reasons to stay in. The one exception here would be that certainly Kasich hurt Rubio in a few states last night. But even there, there's a non-trivial chance that Kasich might be the best chance of stopping Trump in Ohio. So, you know, Trump's still the odds-on favorite. Honestly, the most likely scenario he's not the nominee is that he fails to get 1,237 delegates and there's some sort of floor fight at the Republican convention. And if that's the scenario you're looking at, it makes sense for everybody to stay in.
I do want to add one thing real quick, which is if Rubio gets an indication that he can't pull off a Florida victory, which is not, you know, by no means certain, and he should be able to know this a few days before the actual primary is held, although they do have early voting there, he should probably step out and throw his support to Cruz, and that would be the best way to keep going.
Molly Hemingway is senior editor for The Federalist. Mark Hemingway, senior writer for The Weekly Standard. You'll find links to their columns at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Mark, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Molly, thank you.
Have a great week.